So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. I'm Amanda White. Before we get into it, I wanted to tell you about how I'm recording this basically coming off weeks of being sick with a toddler. You know, I don't know if you're a toddler parent, but you know, when you're still taking medicine, antibiotics, you're still finishing them from the last time, and then you already have a new sickness. That's basically what the last couple months have been like for me. And whenever this happens, my brain is really bad at remembering that this is temporary. I assume that there's something wrong with my life. I assume that I will always feel this way. And I forget that, you know, maybe I don't feel great because I haven't slept. My daughter's been sick. I haven't been, you know, exercising, doing all the normal things to take care of myself. And then whenever this happens, I get better. And then I feel incredible. It's like the world reopens for me. And somehow, no matter how many times this happens to me, it doesn't have to be sickness. It could be, you know, something else going on. I always forget that how I feel right now is not how I'm always going to feel. So today we're going to get into the research that really explains why we do this, like why your brain takes what's happening in your body and what's happening as like your current state and projects it into your whole life, pretty much. So this episode is going to get into like the evolution of emotions. I'm going to debunk some myths. It gets into the research. So if you are a therapist, I think you will be obsessed with this episode. You will love it. If you are not a therapist, I still think you will love it too. Just hang on. We get into this, some of the weeds on it, but we're going to actually debunk the idea that we all have these six core emotions, if you've seen Inside Out, and talk about the more nuanced and true version of how emotions evolved. And then most importantly, what you can do about it to manage your emotions better, to take some of the pressure off, to feel better. This is Nuance Needed. We get into the nuance. I hope you love the episode. Let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. I'm Amanda White.
And this is Sam Dalton.
And if you are new here, we are two licensed therapists who often break down mental health concepts, pop culture.
Share our opinions boldly and loudly to all who care to hear. And
we're clearly not good at these opening hooks. So,
no, cold opens are hard.
They are. They're really hard.
We do a cold open and they're really hard. So you try. If you would like to try this, go for it.
It's hard to come up anyway, with a unique thing. We just...
It is. We change. Sometimes we do last names. Sometimes we don't.
It's true. On Substack, we don't do our last names because we assume people know.
Because we assume if you're paying us, you know who we are.
Yeah. Speaking of Substack, we just did an incredible episode that we're really proud of that breaks down all about people who misunderstand what therapy is. And we kind of break down a viral article that was entitled "Parents Are Not Therapists," which we agree with the title, but we don't agree with the assessment.
Or was it therapists aren't parents?
You're right. Sorry. Therapists aren't parents.
Therapists aren't parents.
Parents are also not therapists.
Parents are also not therapists. Either way, you flip it in or out.
It's sort of enmeshment or the opposite. We agree with both.
We agree with both, but then her article just goes off the rails about 10 different times, and we just walk through how problematic it is. And it was a good one.
It was.
So hop over to Substack, and you can see the whole thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. So today we've been doing these sort of research deep dives, which you all have said that you've really loved, which has been really fun for us. And today I am going to get into emotions, which is one of my favorite topics. And I'm going to kind of talk about the evolutionary role of emotions and debunk some myths and talk about how there's actually new research that came out in 2021 that really flipped the idea of what emotions were on their head. A lot of people haven't totally caught up with that yet, like mainstream, obviously, since it's pretty new. So I'm going to get into a lot of the research on that today.
Let's go.
I think let's start here. Let's talk about this classical view of emotions. The classical view of emotions is basically what most of us are taught, that there are like basic universal expressions of emotion. This started with like Darwin. He literally was the one that first talked about how emotions were evolved as signals. The classical view of emotion goes even further, that says they're like biological fingerprints, and that it tracks the idea that, and you've probably heard about this, Sam, that like every facial expression means a certain emotion. And right, like we teach kids this means sadness. If you want to know how someone, I mean, I'm very well, I'm living this right now with a toddler. Everyone says, this is what sadness looks like. What do you think she feels? She looks afraid. You know, she looks angry. And we're kind of taught that there are six basic emotions. If you've watched the movie Inside Out, it is a physical representation of this. You know, the research, this guy named Paul Ekman did this research in the 60s and 70s. He studied faces across cultures and really believed that you can tell, because across cultures, that there are six hardwired basic emotions, so that they were, you know, evolutionarily created. A lot of people really enjoy this belief, which until I like learned about it, I really subscribe to this also, because I think a lot of times if you think that emotions are hardwired, it sort of gives you a sense of like, it helps you sort of destigmatize emotions, right? Because you're like, this is correct. This is what my ancestors felt. This, it has wisdom. As I'm saying this, Sam, like, what are your understanding of what emotions are? Tell me what you think.
I'm feeling really humbled, because I think the thing you're about to say is going to shatter the thing that I've been telling my own clients. So I think in my mind I'm a little like, great, I'm not good at my job.
It's very new research.
Yeah, the past like 3 deep dives that you've done, every single one I've been like, wow, I'm really bad at what I do. So I really appreciate this like training. I feel like these should be like CEUs. I feel like I should be getting CEU credits to be like, oh, wow, like I'm learning how to be a better therapist, because everything I've known is a lie. My understanding, like my training was based on, there's the 6 different emotions. And I even remember like I took an anthropology class and they talked about the study where they showed different faces to different, like different language speakers, right? And all of them were able to have a language, like a word that was the same across languages for each picture.
Yep.
So that was what I was trained in. And then like when you go to grad school, it kind of becomes the focus on, we didn't focus on that as much actually, now that I kind of think about it. I think it was just assumed that like people have feelings.
Yeah.
And our job is to like deal with it. Like I think my clinical exposure, and even when I think of like the supervision that I received after school, it was much more about how we experience the client's emotion more than why the client is experiencing the emotion.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you are right in everything you said. Like this has been the main belief since the 60s. Mm-hmm. This was like a major breakthrough he had in going to different cultures in studying this. This has trickled down all the way to classrooms. Like, it is the dominant theory until, I believe, the original research came out in like 2018, 2017 maybe. And then by she wrote a book called How Emotions Are Made that was one of the most challenging books that I've ever read that like flipped everything I knew on my head and was really like hard to read, but in a great way. Yeah. So essentially what you're talking about, right, is it's even gone all the way down to Malcolm Gladwell actually also wrote a book.
Oh, I read that. I read that one.
And he because this has impacts because it travels all the way down to like the courts, too, where if you think about how much we rely on someone looking remorseful means they feel remorseful. So a lot of times, like, juries really will convict or not based on how someone looks. So if you debunk that assumption that how that emotions always have clear outward expressions, you then have to sort of look at things differently, even in terms of how you understand other people and things like that. So, yeah, he had a chapter on that that's really interesting. So what's fascinating about this is the Ekman studies that he originally did, this cross-cultural research you're talking about, it was in New Guinea in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And he showed photos of posed people in the West with faces, and he had to have them, he had them pick an emotion from the list. And basically the conclusion, because they were able to pick so well, was that facial expressions are universal. Okay, hopefully I don't lose people here. The problem is this research was actually really flawed because he forced people to choose different emotions. He gave people six emotions, these six core like these six options to choose from, and told them, what do you think this person is feeling?
Oh, he didn't let them naturally assign the emotion. He guided them.
It was like a multiple choice question with six. And they looked, and if you look at these emotions, like, it's so interesting too to even think about how TV has changed since, like, laugh tracks, sitcoms. You used to be able to watch Friends as the episode, like Friends is the last laugh track TV show that I watched, probably. Right? The expressions are so over the top. It is so, you can watch them basically and not understand English and know what these characters are feeling.
Yeah.
Because they're so over the top. So that, like, the fact even that we've changed in terms of how we watch TV and we actually can recognize that a character or a person can feel surprised without clapping their hands against their face and going, oh, right? Like, is an evolution of recognizing that you can be surprised without looking so surprised. It's obvious. But I use the example of Friends to be like, these were the types of over-the-top expressions that this group of people had to pick from. It was not just a subtle tear running down someone's face. It was an it was a very over the top example. So let me, Sam, give you, I want you to read about the study that, so essentially, right, this was taken as gospel. This was what was correct because it was people who didn't speak English. And essentially what Lisa Feldman-Barrett and other researchers did was they tried to replicate the study, but they actually took it a step further. The people that Paul Ekman traced, these people in New Guinea, they knew about like the Western world. They were not completely isolated. So that was also a problem is – if you have contact on some level with the West, if you have seen Friends, for example, I'm not saying these people saw Friends, but maybe they did, right? That is going to influence also your ability to pick correctly the emotions.
Right. In 2014, Maria Gendron and Lisa Feldman-Barrett ran a study that basically blew up the idea that facial expressions are universal. They went to Namibia to work with the Himba, a community that a community with almost no exposure to Western media or Western emotion concepts. The point was to find people who hadn't grown up marinating in the same six emotion words we did. They showed participants 36 photos, six actors, each making the six classic universal faces: happy, sad, angry, afraid, disgusted, neutral. Then they ran it two ways. In the first version, they handed participants the six emotion words and said, sort these photos into those six piles. That's basically what Ekman did in his original famous study. The ones every textbook cites. In the second version, no word list. Just sort these into piles of same feeling, as many piles as you want. Label them however you want. When Americans did the free sort, they mostly reproduced the classic categories, though even they couldn't cleanly separate sad from disgusted. When the Himba did the free sort, the universal pattern fell apart. Smiling faces got grouped together, wide-eyed faces got grouped together, but scowls and pouts and nose wrinkles scattered. And when Himba participants labeled their piles, they often didn't reach for emotion words at all. A smiling face might get labeled laughing or looking at something. A behavior, not an internal state. The supposedly universal pattern only showed up when researchers handed participants the Western emotion words first, which again is what Ekman did. Huh.
Tell me about your reaction to that.
I'm feeling confused. And let me kind of tell you why, from like a professional perspective. I think what I struggle with is, I wonder if what we're talking here, and I don't want to get too ahead.
Yeah.
So if I like jump to like, you know, the end point, let me know. But I think what I feel like what we're talking about here is the expression of emotion, not necessarily the feeling of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's universal, like, people experience sadness to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
People experience happiness mm-hmm. to a degree. People experience anger to a degree. I think what we're realizing here is, like, across cultures, how we identify that and what that looks like to us
mm-hmm.
is different.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, going back to your example of like the courtroom, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing with grief.
Yes.
Like grief, people manifest grief very differently.
Yeah.
And that will throw people off, because there's the assumption that if you're grieving, you should be devastated and crying and not getting out of bed and horrible. And then people who are able to move forward get pegged as like weird.
Yeah.
Or even if you think of like the like experience of being surprised,
mm-hmm.
right? How many videos have you seen of somebody getting surprised with something and it's like a look of shock?
Yeah. Or some people hate being surprised.
Or some people get like pissed, right? Like there's no right way. So I don't know. But I find this fascinating that they more identified it as the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm trying to like reconcile in my brain the experience of like talking to people about feelings all day, which you and I do, and seeing that through like all
mm-hmm.
my entire client list, right? Everybody experiences these things, but the behavior and the emoting mm-hmm. of the feeling is different.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
Okay.
And
okay. Tell me why I'm wrong though.
No, I agree with you. And what I think complicates it is, Lisa Feldman Barrett is a neuro researcher. Like, she's a brain researcher.
Oh.
So she also studies people's brains. And her claim, essentially, is that if these emotions are actually hardwired into your brain, like, evolutionarily, they were developed. No one's saying that we don't all feel emotions. We absolutely all feel those six emotions.
Okay.
We all feel probably more emotions than that. But if we're trying to understand how emotions, right, like a lot of times when people are simplifying what emotions are, right, we talk about it like Darwin did. There is a biological fingerprint. There is somewhere in your brain that we know is making this emotion, and everyone has it. If it were hardwired, the belief is there would be some sort of specific brain pattern. Maybe it is not external, but there would be some sort of brain signature. She looked across hundreds, maybe thousands of neuroimaging studies of we have images of what happens, how your brain lights up to different emotions. And there is no consistent one-to-one brain region that creates like emotion mapping. The amygdala, right, which we say is the fear center, It lights up across all different types of emotions as well. It's not just fear. It's lots of different things. Her whole belief is that emotions are not biologically hardwired. They're actually constructions of multiple things. What she found is there are four states that are, if you think they're biologically hardwired, the best place to look is in babies. Babies would be able to have anger and sadness and all of these things. And I mean, babies cry, babies look angry. Like you could, if you could maybe say that. But without language, how do we know what, like her whole thing is that language is what creates an emotion.
Language is what gives it meaning.
Exactly. If it's not biologically hardwired into you, you need language to understand or have the experience of understanding what anger is. Otherwise, it's just like feelings and, you know, it's just like high heart rate, like low, you know, like it's right. just chemicals running through your body, essentially. Because, again, we know from neurostudy or neuroimaging, there isn't one particular pattern that shows up when someone feels angry. It's so different depending on the person. But what is consistent and shows up in babies and shows up in studies is there are four quadrants where what seems to be hardwired into us is high energy, low energy. Babies feel this. Everyone feels this. It can be a part of how you feel. It's high energy, low energy. And then essentially also high pleasantness, low pleasantness, which essentially just means like content or not. And if like I really like thinking about it as a baby because it makes sense, right? Like a baby may not have the complexity of anger, but the baby knows if they're happy or like if they're content or not and if they're, you know, tired or not.
Right.
And then it's words that end up essentially making this what an emotion is. Because if anger and fear and sadness like are actually discrete hardwired categories in your brain, there would have there would be a biological structure in your brain. Like the amygdala, if its job was just fear, it wouldn't light up in lots of other situations, essentially is the whole argument. But what this analysis did show, right, is sort of what we're circling around, that emotional experiences are built in general purpose brain networks. So emotions, like the whole idea is emotions are constructed based on that high pleasantness, low pleasantness, whether you're high or low energy, and then based on context in a lot of ways. And I want to give you an example of, have you ever, Sam, thought you were really mad and then you were hungry?
Yes.
Yeah. Or you thought you were, I don't know, really sad and you were like tired.
Yes.
Or like, I think a lot about how I get anxious and my stomach hurts, but I get anxious and I've eaten too much. like right? Like it is so.
Yeah.
So what the whole theory is your brain is making predictions based on all of this context that's going on in your body, like the, you know, how the chemicals are in your body, but also how you physically feel, like whether you're hungry or full, whether you're tired or not, whether you feel okay, like whether you're itchy or not, whether, and it's why I think emotions are so complicated and are so different for people, because it is all of these different sensations that you're trying to make sense of.
I feel like what I'm thinking right now is that we are just animals that figured out how to build things really good.
Exactly.
Like while you were explaining that, I was like, if all we're talking about here is like energy, low energy. Like, so we've just complicated everything.
Well, I think we are complicated, right? Well, I mean, yeah, we have like the, you know, compared to an animal, we have the ability to think about the future, to think about right. ourselves.
We have a frontal lobe.
We have a frontal yeah. lobe. Yeah, it is like, I think it's such a good example. Obviously, I'm an evolution nerd, but it's such a good example of how we act like the day we learned to walk and use tools, we had different brains than the day before. But everything was a slow build from an animal. From an ape. Like, from so an it ape. Does actually make way more sense, because otherwise you're saying, if you believe there's a biological hardwired component, one day on the map, our brains changed and we felt anger, which doesn't make sense, actually.
My professional training is like butting up against this mm-hmm. because of the complexity of the human mind and the frontal lobe. And let's not even start talking about the concept of a soul, right? Like, we're not gonna crack open that piggy bank. But like, I like just the amount of stories that I have heard over my career, right? My 14-year career mm-hmm. at this point, the amount of life experiences that I've heard, and the same feelings that people experience, but it's different meaning attached mm-hmm. to it based on their family unit, their life experience, things that they've been through, things that they haven't been through, their belief systems, right? Like, it's all different, so much so because of the external, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting here trying to think, like, okay, if it might just be like a very simple graph of like high energy, low energy, how...
I will answer like, that for you. So
please
let me show you what this looks like. This is called a mood meter. This is a very aggressive website. I'm just going to have you live react to this website and you'll scroll down to see the mood meter.
Okay. All right. Let's live. Get my live reaction.
Okay, hold on. Where is the chat feature? Here we go. Studio chat. Here we go.
Ah.
Do you want to describe it?
Yeah. So I immediately open it up and it's a giant black screen with huge white letters that says, "Feel your feelings." Yeah. In all capital letters, the words stacked on each other. That's really intense.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my God, the colors.
Yes.
Whoa.
So if you scroll down, this is the mood meter. This is what I like to use with clients instead of the feeling wheel. If you are a therapist or you are someone who loves the feeling wheel, great. There's nothing wrong with it. I just find it really helpful, especially when I work with clients who really struggle to understand how they feel, and like it feels like they're making up a word. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I've worked with clients who are so dissociated, like especially if they're coming off of like, you know, addiction and stuff like that. It is truly, they're so dissociated from their body, they cannot feel anything. But typically people can tell you if they're tired or not, and if they're like okay or not.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing when someone's like, how do you feel? Bad.
Right. For those of you that don't know what we're looking at, it is like four quadrants, and I will explain this, and probably this will be confusing. I'm sorry. If you look at high energy, low energy, high pleasantness, no pleasantness. So let's say if you are high energy, high pleasantness, that is like happy, ecstatic, excited, right? The most extreme mm-hmm. version is like ecstatic.
Yeah.
Then if we're talking on the other side of the spectrum, low pleasantness, low energy, that is like depression, despair, disappointed, despondent. If you look at high pleasantness, low energy, that is like calm, serene, mm-hmm. restful.
Sleepy.
Mm-hmm. And then high energy, low pleasantness, angry, enraged, all of it. But it gives you a sense of sort of like the difference between annoyed and enraged is often different. Right, like energy, you are more energetic when you're enraged, and you are also typically you know, it's a not as unpleasant if you're just irritated.
I'm kind of having an existential crisis looking at this for myself, because I think I'm realizing I don't think I spend a lot of time in the high energy, high pleasantness quadrant.
Ecstatic.
Ecstatic. I saw that word and I was like, have I ever felt ecstatic in my life? I spend a lot of time in the high energy, low pleasantness quadrant. But also, no, I'm actually either the high energy, high pleasantness quadrant or the high energy, low pleasantness mm-hmm. quadrant. So I think I'm high energy. I'm really going to incorporate this into my work because uh-huh. I think it helps you. It conceptualizes it so much better. I really love the feelings wheel because I think just giving people yeah. vocabulary so much when you're working with them is just like the first step.
Totally.
And in understanding emotions are so much more broad.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get into that.
Than just simply like happy, sad, mad, glad kind of thing. But I think this helps make it feel like more concrete of what is actually going on in your body.
Right. It gives people like a physical sensation to latch on.
Yes. This feels much more somatic
mm-hmm.
to me looking at this. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing Sam wasn't doing that she should have been. Okay.
If you were listening to this episode and thinking, I could really use some more support with my emotions, I have the solution for you, or I have some support for you. My practice, Therapy for Women, has licensed therapists in 43 states across the country. That's right. We have 43. We just got New York. So if you live in New York, we can finally support you. We rarely have openings in California, and we have openings for California. Again, our bread and butter is Philadelphia. We have 4 offices in the Philadelphia, South Jersey area. And then licensed states across the country. If you are also looking for full wraparound care, we have a nutritionist, we have a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner. And we really specialize in treating the female experience as a whole. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, definitely check us out, therapyforwomencenter.com.
All right, everybody, gather around because Mother's Day is coming up and I have the plan for how you are going to spoil your mom, a mom that is important to you, a mom of your friend, basically any mom that you would like. I'm going to give you the plan, okay? You are going to go to Cozy Earth and you are going to get her literally anything. But ideally, the combo that I've come up with for my mom is we are going to do robes, slippers, sheets, and a blanket, okay? I am going to wrap my mom in the softest, coziest pajamas and sheets and robes and slippers that I have ever personally tried in my life. I just think the reason I'm putting this like package together like this is because I think it is so special for the women in our life who work so hard and give so much and rarely think of themselves, and they need to be thinking of themselves more, to give them this gift, whatever you end up getting them, right? To let them know that they need a moment to themselves. And they need a moment to rest and chill and to do that in some of the most comfortable sheets, pajamas, blankets, robes, and slippers I have literally ever used in my life. So with that said, I also want to let you know, you get a 100-night sleep trial with any of the products. So you can try it for 100 nights and decide at any point in there that you don't like it and send it back. But also, if you do decide you like it, these products are covered with a 10-year warranty. You get 10 years of use out of these products. Your mom will thank you for this cost-saving measure gift, okay? So with all that said, I have a special gift for you. If you use code NUANCE at checkout, you get 20% off. That's code NUANCE, N-U-A-N-C-E, because home starts with mom. Can't wait to hear what you guys think.
I want to get into now, why is the vocabulary important? There is a term essentially called emotion, right? If emotions are not hardwired, and then emotions are constructed. They're things that we understand based on language, based on the words we have, based on context and what's going on in our lives, and even based on how we understand other people, right? And none of this, mm-hmm. like, none of this is saying it's you shouldn't it's, I mean, I still teach my toddler, like, this is what it looks like to be upset, right? Because you can't get in her brain. I can't get in her brain and be like, this is how it feels inside. I can talk about your body, but she doesn't even have, like, the words to understand anything. So all of this is to say, like, everything we're doing is still appropriate. This is just, like, the next level of it. So essentially, there's a word called emotional granularity, which essentially means the more words, the more emotion words you have, the better you're going to be able to understand yourself and understand the world and take care of yourself. The metaphor I really love for this is, right, I think about my daughter. She knows a few emotion words, really. No. Typically, people know a few. It's actually shocking if you look into the research of the average person only knows 5 emotion words.
What?
Yes. It's bad. It's bad.
Wow. Wow.
And think about how limiting your life is if you only understand 5 emotions, which again is why if we think about them as construction, it helps you understand yourself in the world. So it is like if you are painting and you only have a few colors, that is the depth of Sam paints, I don't. That is the level of detail you will be able to create in a piece of artwork compared to if we have a lot of emotion words and we understand the nuances. This is why the mood meter is colored, right? We understand the nuances between a bright yellow and a lighter yellow. We can get a lot more depth in creating a piece of art. The same is true for our lives. The more emotion words you know, the better you're going to be able to narrate and understand yourself and understand other people. Because if you only know the word angry and you don't know the word annoyed, you're going to be angry more often.
Because you're not going to understand that there is a spectrum to what you are experiencing.
Exactly. And then that gets reinforced.
Mm.
So that's why it's really good and important for us to know lots of different emotion words. And yes, like those 6 emotions are like make sense in terms of their wide variety that then you can get into the details of.
Right.
But it what matters is the amount of emotions. And I know it for me, at least, I remember spending way too much time, I think, with clients in the past being like, what is the core emotion? When it really doesn't matter. What matters is the word that makes sense to them and helps them understand their experience and the world.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because if we're going to get in the clinical weeds here, so everybody come on the journey with us if you want the inside scoop of how therapists think about things. There's so much emphasis on like the experience of the feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And helping people tap into what they're feeling. And obviously that is incredibly important, and I do it in almost every session in some form. I think what I have started to find with my clients is you can kind of get into a debate of like chicken or the egg of like thought, feeling, thought, right? What comes before what? What I've found actually is that instead of perseverating on what you're feeling, and somatic therapists everywhere are about to have a nervous breakdown, I actually find that understanding what you're thinking and exploring why that specific thought evokes particular emotions in you is far more beneficial than just simply telling someone, you're feeling this, great. Learn how to sit in that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the sitting in it is the important element that comes after that processing work.
Yep.
But I find that it's really like, because we're having so many thoughts all through the day that are all tied to different things in our life and things that have different meaning and different experience and different value to us, the thought can often provoke the feeling.
Yeah.
But then people assume that they're just naturally feeling something, which technically at a biological level you are.
Yeah.
But really, like, you've triggered yourself.
Yeah.
And I use that word like sparingly, right? Like, I'm not saying you can't ever like have a thought.
It activated the emotion in you, if we wanted to be the more, the more clinical term.
Hyper professional, whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, Yeah. And so I've found that like helping people explore like the connection between those two things, mm-hmm. that your thoughts and your feelings are interconnected because of the complexity of your brain and your frontal lobe and kind of this high energy, low energy experience. And that, and I think that helps introduce to people that just because you are feeling something doesn't mean that something is actually occurring that could cause you to feel that way.
Totally. I think what you're talking about, though, Sam, is like, I do think we get, sometimes us therapists get very stuck mm-hmm. on, I think there are like very CBT therapists that are like, it's all about the thoughts and we need to dispute the thoughts, which is something I personally right. really suffered from as a result when I was yeah. growing up in therapy, because I had so many feelings and it was like, mm-hmm. I couldn't handle someone telling me that like my feelings weren't important right. to dissect. I think we can overcorrect sometimes and we can be like, there is a, it's like kind of like we talked about in the catharsis episode, like there is a unique it, like thing in mm-hmm. you. If we break it open and we, you know, release yeah. this feeling, you will then be healed. And it
right.
and it's what you're saying, Sam. It is actually, and it's what that catharsis research talked about, is it's important to feel your feelings, but you also have to understand them and use words and just screaming or yelling or doing whatever is not alone healing. We also mm-hmm. have to have mm-hmm. the context and the interpretation, which fits with what we're talking about, which is to say that like your body matters, but your brain is always regulating your yes. body. And it is not, your brain is not great at always no. knowing what's going on. And your brain can make like bad predictions sometimes. Like I think the classic example that I always think of with myself is like when I am sick, which is often when you have a toddler, I think everything in my life is horrible. And my brain is really bad at remembering that because I am physically not feeling great, maybe that is contributing to why I don't feel excited about my life today. But if we don't, right, if we believe that if we overly weigh emotions or overly weigh thoughts, we are missing out on that ability to be flexible.
I think you just like hit the nail on the head for me in how my approach in therapy works. Is I think there's a lot of all or nothing thinking that can enter into therapy.
Yeah.
Very easily. And I think this emotions are so complex, and I think because so few people are taught the language
yep.
and it like given an understanding of what all of this means and how to be regulated and how to experience emotion, it's so rare.
Yeah.
Like it really is. Like even the people that are doing it the best they can are screwing up.
Yep.
Because it's hard.
Yep.
Because it's really hard. And I think what I've found is like so many people beat themselves up so hard for having these feelings.
Yeah.
For having like a flow in what they feel, right?
Yeah.
And I think this goes with the obsession of like, I need to be happy.
Yes.
I want to be happy. I need to be happy. It's like, no, you don't. You just need to figure out how to exist at a baseline that feels comfortable for you and allows you to have healthy connection and a good life and meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love what you just said, Sam, because it's like if we look at it then from like to be happy requires high energy, yeah, right? Like you're not going to have high energy all the time. You're just not. So it's unrealistic to think you will always have high energy.
I mean, I literally just disclosed to all of you I've never experienced being ecstatic. So like that's
– I am someone who swings hard and I think it is because of my sensory issues. I can she get does, so guys. Happy she... from something that's like the feeling of a blanket.
Do you turn into like one of those grasshoppers yes. where you like yes. aggressively like rub your feet
exactly.
together?
I mean, shout out to like, Cozy yeah. Earth, which is like my favorite thing in the world. Their sheets.
Oh.
Use Nuance for 20% off. I love them.
They're literally the best they thing are. That you will ever put on truly. Your body. Whether you slide into bed or whether you're wearing the pajamas or whether you have both at the same time.
But even I've talked to you about how I have like an unnaturally like positive reaction to stretching. Like stretching
she does.
Feels so incredible. in my body, like, so I am someone who can swing positive to negative because the same happens if I have the wrong texture on my body. It's like I'm being tortured. So, you know, I think there's something to be said, Sam, for being more steady.
No, I just like control. Like, I can't, if someone was like, throw something across your room and leave it there, wouldn't happen.
What do you mean by
that? I can't
do
it.
You can't throw something.
You know, like if someone was like, oh, just like throw your clothes on the floor.
Yeah. I can.
No. I can't. Even if I, like the thought of like intentionally making a mess.
I do get very upset about things being ruined. Especially, it's really fun having a toddler. I'm like, I'm watching you purposely destroy my house.
And I'm letting you do it.
Or I have to stop you. The amount of time and effort that I'm just like, all you want to do is destroy my house. That's your favorite activity.
It's your favorite pastime.
Yeah.
Well, like a month or so ago, my friends and I went to a vision boarding night.
Okay.
And I'm apparently friends with some of the most creative people in the world because the stuff that they were like cutting out and they were like making all these pictures and like everything had meaning and they were bringing in like color and this and that. And they were like diamonds and like everything. And I was just like, I want a house. Here's a house. Like
that would be
and I could, but it was weird because like I had this desire to be creative, but I was like so fearful of like not doing it well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a little entrance into my psyche and what I think of during the day. But
if emotions, right, were hardwired into us also, you would expect that every culture and every language would have all of the same emotion words. But they don't. Right? I think a lot of us know that German word that I'm going to butcher that you can probably.
Schadenfreude?
It's the experience of pleasure, joy, or self-satisfaction from learning of other people's failure or humiliation.
Hearing the definition makes me realize that I am a Schadenfreude expert.
But, like, it's so good because whenever I use that word and I use it as an example, people know that immediately. It is not something that anyone has to be like, I don't know, maybe I've thought about that before. People know immediately. And that's one of the coolest things is just like learning about, right, like these different words, I think also, because it just shows how clear it is that, like, another one, this was a really good one too. Okay, in Taglong, there's a word called gigil. It is the overwhelming urge to squeeze something so cute. Like, you might lose it if you see one more baby or puppy.
Oh.
It's like cute aggression as a word.
Yeah. Because that is a very real thing. I do get angry when I see a cute dog.
I know. You want to, like, eat its face a little bit.
You want to, like, yeah.
Then in Japanese, there's a word called ame, the pleasure of being able to depend on someone.
Oh, love.
There are so many cool different emotion words in different languages, and that is one of the things she actually recommends in her book of, like, if you want to expand your emotional vocabulary, look up other words in other languages because it will give you even more words. It's like the idea of, right, like the Inuit people have so many different words for snow. So it's this whole idea. That's what I was saying about with context is it's like, if you have all of this, if you have all these different words for snow, you're going to have all these different conversations about snow because you're going to talk about wet snow and deep snow and a snowbank.
Sleet.
Yeah, like all like snow. I mean, they have one that's called snow used for drinking water specifically.
Oh.
Right. So it's like all of these different words then create this whole world that you can participate in, and it makes you look at snow differently. And that's sort of the whole thesis of, like, that's why it's good to have all these different emotion words. That's why it's good to not get fixated on exactly which emotion you feel, because the richer you want, like, the more you understand yourself, the more emotion words you have, the more you understand your emotions, the better you're going to also be able to take care of yourself, because you're going to not just be able to regulate your experience because you don't jump to the most extreme version, but you're also going to be able to experience a richer version of life, right? If you think about the, what, like a may, like you, because words are self-enforcing, like this language creates itself also. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's this double thing where it makes your life richer, but then you can also regulate your emotions. And that is sort of, I rest my case thesis of why emotions are not hardwired and they're constructed with language and are complicated.
I think what I'm hearing is that I think there are just some cultures that do complexity better than others, and uncertainty, and just open-ended, like this is a thing, mm-hmm. you know? But I think to loop it back to like Schadenfreude,
yeah.
right? Think of how beautiful it is that it's a universal experience that we've all visualized the demise of our enemies.
Yeah. But it's like you haven't even known that you thought that until you have a word for it. That's what's so cool. Until you have a
word for it. And then you're like, I too
yeah.
want my enemies to
perish.
Suffer. We've all thought it. Mm-hmm. Like, and yeah, I, you know, the people that cause my clients harm, I wish them harm. I can't tell them that in session, but I do. I don't wish my clients harm. I wish the people that have harmed them harm.
Yeah.
Because I'm a human, because I experienced mm-hmm. Schadenfreude. So I think, like, even if you want to go as broad as, like, Western or more Western versus more Eastern cultures, right? I think it's interesting because some Eastern cultures will be seen as, like, more reserved. But at the same time, I feel like they do a really good job of addressing the internal complexity that you experience on an individual scale. They just have the belief that you shouldn't talk about it. So like they like feel things yeah. like very intensely and have like a very broad spectrum for that. But then kind of like this idea of like honor and being reserved and whatever.
We're Americans, and I'm obviously just, broad stroking, you know, word vomit yeah. our four emotions.
we word vomit like I'm angry all the time. Like that's just what we do in the West. Or you could be a Brit and you just never talk about anything ever, other than the fact that it's raining, which they actually do have quite a few words for rain.
There you go.
Yeah, so that's how they express complexity.
Well, I think you're correct, completely correct about that, because I remember reading that. Actually, and I think this is why they say look up other emotion words. English has very few emotion words yes. compared to other languages.
Yeah.
Which shows yeah. you something.
English speakers have a lot of problems, and it goes back a long ways. And we could have – maybe I'll do a colonialism yes, deep dive one day. But I think with so much of this – and what's interesting is I've found that this is a theme lately in my own work of like allowing complexity to exist – and that things are varied and nuanced. Something can have a lot of meaning in the moment without giving your life larger meaning, right? Like you can experience like sadness or anger or grief or frustration or annoyance. And you can experience those things on a micro scale that doesn't have to mean it's the macro meaning of your life.
Yes. You can have a bad day, right, Sam?
Yeah. You can have a bad day. You can have a bad week. Mm-hmm. To allow and to not force ourselves into an emotion that we don't have the energy for
mm-hmm.
or we don't feel we can get into at the moment, right? Which is why I'm so obsessed with like, stop worrying about being happy. You don't have to be happy. Mm-hmm. You can just be meh. Like that is fine. And also that like sometimes things are hard because that thing is like categorically hard. Mm-hmm. Or like you're feeling sad because that is a sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think to stop putting all this pressure on ourselves that we have to be in a different feeling to be doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's okay. It's okay if you're just experiencing sadness or a version of that. Or if you don't know what you're feeling either.
Yeah.
That's an experience too. That you don't know the word for what you're experiencing and you just kind of have to let it ride.
I love like grounding stuff in evolution. Sorry, guys.
Bring it on, babe.
No, I just love it because it allows you to take things less seriously sometimes.
Yes.
And as someone yes. who takes things too seriously and too literally a lot of times, I find it very grounding to like look back at things and be like, there's so much pressure, like you were talking about, to feel a certain way. There's so much pressure if you feel like you have to know the exact right emotion that you're feeling and you have to do the exact right thing to cope with it, or you're doing it wrong. And this just like allows for a lot more like, I don't know, you're going to feel good, you're going to feel bad, you're going to, you know, you're going to be pleasant, you're going to be unpleasant, you're going to have, obviously emotions are important and matter, but it's, you can take things in context much easier because it is not a biological imperative that you have to like excavate this anger and heal it.
If we look at something as complex as like grief,
yeah,
right? Let's take something that people think is a one note yes. experience. It's not. You like a week after someone dies could maybe actually have like a steady day.
You could feel happy.
Right? You could feel happy. You could feel joy thinking of a memory, thinking of something that you liked. Like somebody does something kind for you in the midst of your grief and you find that you're able to like tap into that for a little bit, right? It might be muted, might not be the same as what it was prior to this happening, but nothing is one note. Nothing. And you're not weird or broken or bad because you have a varied emotional experience to something. In fact, that's the rule. Like that's really what this whole thing is. And I think people try really hard to like shove themselves in a box because that feels easier to comprehend.
Totally. And I think you did a good job of explaining also how we can then like, right, we talk a lot on this podcast about like the worst thing you can do with your emotions is like judge them, beat yourself up,
yeah.
get mad about it. Right. That stops the processing essentially. But
right.
If you recognize that grief or sadness isn't one note, it makes sense how you can go into different feelings and you then don't have to beat yourself up about it. Like I think one of the most common experiences is people feel happy sometimes or they forget when something terrible has happened and then they feel yeah. bad and they beat themselves up about it, that they have a moment of joy. But if we can accept that just because you're grieving doesn't mean it's only one feeling, again, it can be more of this fluid experience.
Right. Yeah. This was good.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I know. I just keep showing up every week. I'm like, no. How am I going to find out I'm crap at my job today?
These are my big ones. The other ones I'm going to have to research and be humbled. A lot of them, though, Sam, I just got humbled a week before you. This one I knew because I did research on it, but everything else, I'm just humbled a week before.
No, I show up and I'm like, well, lied to that person today. That's good to know. I'll have to address that next time. I'll have to tell them, hey, remember when I told you to hit something with a baseball bat? You shouldn't do that. You didn't do that, did you?
As always, we love you guys so much. Let us know if you like these deep dives, if you have topics. Sam has a lot of fun history, pop culture.
It's coming up.
Once.
Yep, they're coming.
Cool.
So.
All right, head over to our Substack.
Yep, anything that you can do to rate, review, share, subscribe, comment, it would mean the absolute world. It's how we keep getting the word out about the pod and how we keep chugging along. And you're the best.
See you next week.
Bye.